listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
The National Institute on Drug Abuse defines addiction as, quote, a chronic relapsing brain disease that is characterized by compulsive drug seeking and use despite harmful consequences. But in recent years, an increasing number of experts have started calling that definition into question. And one of those experts is Mark Lewis, a neuroscientist and professor of developmental psychology at Radboud University in the Netherlands. He's also a former drug addict. His latest book, The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease, published by Public Affairs. I'm very pleased it has brought Dr. Lewis to our show today. Hello.
Hi there.
And if any of our listeners would like to join in on the conversation, our number is 212-433-9692. Or you can write to us on our show page at WNYC.org or find us on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at Leonard LoPage. If addiction isn't a disease, then what is it?
It's a learned habit of thought and feeling. And I know that doesn't quite do it justice because we have lots of habits and addiction is obviously a very destructive habit. But it's still a habit. And what that means is that it's a form of thinking and acting that is repetitive and self-reinforcing and stabilized and crystallized in a person's repertoire. And it keeps feeding itself.
But sometimes when you can break certain habits.
Right.
But if you are an alcoholic, you have delirium tremens.
Yeah, that's right.
So that's more than just a habit.
It's not just a habit. It's a particular kind of habit. And so habits are learned, right? I mean, that's one thing we can say about them. And the way you ride a bike, the way you do your toast in the morning, those are all habits. And as you say, they can be stopped fairly easily if they're destructive. Addictive habits are very hard to stop. And so there's something particular about that that we need to understand.
Do other species exhibit addictive tendencies, or is there something about humans that makes us especially addiction prone?
Well, one of the interesting controversies in the addiction world is that a lot of addiction research is done with animals, so that we know that other animals, for example, rats and mice, can be addicted to addictive drugs. There's a problem of definition because some substances are physically addictive. As you say, alcohol, stopping alcohol suddenly can give you DTs. With opiates, we know that there is a period of a week or two or even 3 or 4 weeks of extreme discomfort. But there are other drugs, such as cocaine, methamphetamine, that don't give you withdrawal symptoms. And yet, they're very hard to quit. So they're not physically addictive, but they're psychologically addictive. And we can't really test out that difference with rats.
Cigarettes as well. But mm-hmm. also, other kinds of things are called addictive, like gambling.
Right. That's right. So that's the other thing, is that there are these so-called process addictions or behavioral addictions, which include gambling, sex addiction, porn addiction, and now internet gaming addiction, and there's a couple of others as well.
What's neuroplasticity?
And so if we're going to get into the brain, I guess the first thing to say is that the process addictions, the behavioral addictions, show very similar brain activation patterns as do substance addictions. They really don't look different at all. And so we have to go back to the NIDA definition that you started off with and say addiction as a chronic brain disease, well, it's not that drugs hijack the brain. If anything is messing up the brain, it's addiction. It's not drugs per se.
So
you asked about neuroplasticity, and it just means it's the way the brain functions. The brain functions through constantly reconfiguring itself.
And it does it whether we're talking about behavioral or substance addiction?
It does it all the time. It does it right now as we're having a conversation in this lab. As we learn things from each other, we are modifying our neural networks, our synaptic networks, the connections between brain cells. They continue to modify themselves with learning. That's the only way you can learn, is by modifying those networks.
Some things, like opiates, are addictive because the body already has receptors for them.
Right.
That's how endorphins were discovered.
Right. So opiates are a kind of drug that mimics an endogenous chemical, a chemical that we build within our bodies, the endogenous opioids. There's a few different types of them. And so opiate drugs go to the same receptor sites and make you feel essentially what your endogenous opiates make you feel, but maybe 1,000 times stronger.
But then there are other kinds of highs. What chemical processes are involved in triggering a high? Different for obvious for opiates than for marijuana or alcohol?
Right. So the different drugs trigger a high in different ways. And as we said, gambling also is a high, which is triggered in another way. So drugs make you feel a certain way based on their chemistry, obviously. And alcohol is an interesting drug because there are no alcohol receptors. So what alcohol does, for example, is it changes the balance of excitatory and inhibitory transmitters in different parts of the brain. But there's no alcohol receptor. So it just kind of changes your ongoing electrochemical activity in a whole bunch of different ways. Whereas things like methamphetamine trigger the high by stimulating the release of and slowing down the reuptake of neurochemicals like dopamine and norepinephrine.
But we can take any of those drugs in moderation and have no problem.
Right.
What happens? When is the line crossed?
Yeah. In fact, statistics show that most people who use drugs don't get addicted. Even the addictive drugs, the so-called addictive drugs like coke and even heroin, most people who try them do not get addicted. So when do you cross the line? It's hard to define. It's obviously, it can be a creeping, insidious process by which the attraction gets stronger and stronger. Other goals become less and less attractive, and it becomes the only game in town. And that can take weeks. It can take months. I think you know you're addicted when you really know you should stop, you really want to stop, and you have a hard time doing so.
On the other hand, you describe love and addictions as being very similar.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I want to get past love.
Haven't you ever been in love with somebody that you didn't want to be in love with?
Well, when it caused problems, yes. Yeah,
that's what I'm saying, when it causes problems. So with love, you get similar things. You get a strong uptake of this neurotransmitter dopamine to an area called the striatum, which is in charge of goal seeking. It's basically in charge of desire, focusing on a goal and going after it. And we feel desire and a very narrow focus on our loved object, on your girlfriend or whoever it is, which is similar in many ways to the way people feel about the drugs that they're addicted to. Yeah, okay, love can be a really nice thing, but it's not a nice thing when you fall in love with your friend's wife or something, or someone you're not supposed to fall in love with, or someone who doesn't love you back, or someone who's abusive. And these are all stories that are not that different in form than drug addiction.
My guest is Mark Lewis, whose latest book is The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. Now, the DSM-5 categorizes addictions as substance use disorders.
Right.
What's the big difference between a disease and a disorder?
Not much. It's a bit of a euphemism.
You object to both of those?
I don't mind disorder as much, but it's a loose enough term that it can mean almost anything. But the thing is that where the power and money and influence is, for example, in NIDA, whose definition you read out, this is the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and it's one of the branches of NIH, the National Institute of Health. And NIDA actually funds 90% of the addiction research in the world. So it's tremendously powerful and influential. And they make no bones about it. They say addiction is a chronic brain disease. So they're bypassing the DSM, and they're saying this is what it is. It's a disease. And Nora Volkow, the head of NIDA, argues that assiduously every chance she gets.
Despite the fact that you say the research would suggest otherwise.
Well, I think it suggests otherwise.
She doesn't. This all depends on how you interpret the research.
Yeah.
Aren't some people more addictive prone than others?
Yeah.
We talk about people having addictive personalities. Is this there's a genetic thing involved? If that's the case, then it would be a brain disease.
Possibly. However, we could have... Well, first of all, the proneness is partly genetic and partly environmental. There's a lot of environmental impacts that cause a person to become vulnerable to addiction. For example, childhood adversity, childhood trauma, whether it's physical or sexual or emotional abuse, set the person up, the covariation between that kind of PTSD resulting from those experiences and addiction is really high. So that's the environmental part, and that's really important because we can actually do something about that.
Well, people grow up in families where there's serious alcoholism or drug addiction.
So that's part of it, too.
They're more likely to have to deal with it themselves when they become adults.
So they might be learning addiction by modeling. I mean, they're modeling kids often end up doing what their parents do because that's what they've learned to do. But the genetic part is also an overlay.
Then there are certain countries that have problems, alcohol problems and the like. I would guess that's just simply part of the culture.
Yes, that's right. There's cultural factors too. And culture also determines what you define as an addiction. So in some places, taking a particular substance day after day is not considered an addiction at all. Well, we take coffee, you know, several times a day, and we don't call that an addiction. Most of us don't.
Well, when I don't have my cup of coffee.
We do,
and then I start having the DTs.
That's right. We do, and then we laugh about it or smile about it. But this is not the way we feel about taking opiates every day.
Is there some kind of link with depression?
Very much so. Depression, anxiety, PTSD, those are the big ones. And what they all have in common is that you don't feel comfortable with yourself. You don't feel at home in the world. You feel off, you feel distressed, you feel anxious, you feel at risk. And many drugs will either soothe that feeling or else distract you from it.
Now, the disease model is the basis of the 12-step program, isn't it?
Sort of. Not really the basis. The 12-step program evolved since 1935, mostly seeing addiction as a spiritual and psychological malady. They also threw in the term that it's an allergy, but they started to use the disease nomenclature in the 50s and 60s when 12-step philosophy merged with residential treatment and the medical influences on drug treatment. When those things came together, then the disease label started to get shared, and it kind of coalesced, and it spread into the AA culture as well.
Hasn't it been suggested that some people become addicted to AA?
Sure, yeah.
They substitute their addiction to alcohol for the addiction to going to those meetings to deal with their addiction to alcohol.
Yeah. I mean, I don't see that as such a terrible thing. We can substitute our addiction to destructive, dangerous drugs with lots of other kinds of habits, like relationship habits, like being in love with somebody or, you know, spending time with your kids. That can be addictive too, but it's a lot healthier.
Let's take a call. Lily from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. I think it's important. The reason why people push to categorize addiction as a disease, as far as I know, is to try to bring some sympathy to addicts, because we have a nature as a people to criminalize addicts and put them in jail, and we still do, rather than try to help them and treat them properly. And so the push to, it's not about whether it's a disease or not. It's about categorizing it as a disease to get people help rather than just throw them in jail for the rest of their lives.
You're absolutely right. That is part of the motivation to
medicalize it.
To medicalize it, to save addicts from experiencing a lot of shame and blame and degradation. The stigma of addiction is very powerful. And also, yes, to keep them out of jail. And, of course, I agree with all those agendas. But we don't have to call it a disease in order to treat people with problems in a humane way. I mean, I think we understand by now that people make wrong turns and get into difficulties in their life because of circumstances and problems. And I don't think that means we have to put them in jail unless we call it a disease.
Disagree that we understand, because our jail population is through the roof and it's not getting any better. So I don't think people understand it at all. I think we need to call it a disease so that people will understand even a little bit.
You're from Canada,
yeah,
and now you teach in the Netherlands.
Yeah.
Do those countries have different attitudes about what to deal with addicts than we do in the United States?
Partially. But, you see, I'd like to increase our understanding of addiction by going beyond the disease label, which is kind of boxing it, categorizing it, and handing it off to the experts. I think we can understand it a lot better, and that's what I try to do in my work. In other countries, yes, there is less tendency to put addicts in jail. But even here, with Obama's recent pardons and getting nonviolent offenders out of jail, that's been a wonderful, you know, that's been definitely a step in the right direction.
My guest is Mark Lewis, a neuroscientist and professor of developmental psychology. He's at Radboud University in the Netherlands. His latest book is The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. It's published by Public Affairs. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Professor Mark Lewis. His book, The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease, published by Public Affairs. Throughout the book, you take aim at what you call the rehab industry.
Mm-hmm.
What do they do that's wrong?
You might ask what they do that's right.
Well, Amy Winehouse, for example, famously said she wasn't going to go to rehab, but she finally did, and for a while, that improved her life. She had other issues.
Sure. Residential rehabs have a pretty poor success rate. So most of the people that you find in a residential rehab are not there for the first time. They're there for their second, third, fourth, fifth time, and so forth. Outpatient rehabs tend to work better because the trouble with residential rehabs is you're in some lovely pastoral environment for a month or two, and yes, you've managed to get off drugs for a while, and then you're discharged back into your home community where you got addicted in the first place. It's very hard to maintain those gains. Also, they cost a fortune, and most people cannot afford them. And they seduce clients into their care by saying, you've got a disease, we can help you, we've got what it takes to help you. Whereas, in fact, the treatment they provide is a hodgepodge of medical and 12-step. A lot of it is 12-step-based treatment, which just isn't very effective for most people.
Let's take some more calls. Dave from Port Jervis, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Hi.
I told your screener that I had heard about a program that happened about 8 years ago, but I think it's more like 15 years ago or 10 years ago. In Switzerland, that they wind up taking a bunch of heroin-addicted people, and they were so concerned with this particular park where they all focused on, and they had a high crime, they had a lot of things, so they decided to just get the heroin-addicted people the heroin they wanted, and it was administered by hospitals and so forth. They just had to come in. These people wind up living a more productive life. Crime went down drastically.
Right.
And I wanted to know, what was your opinion about that?
Now, isn't that based on the British model? For years, Britain, you could go to jail for smoking marijuana, but if you were a heroin addict, you went to a doctor and it gave you a prescription for heroin or some other drug that would get you through.
So in Britain, you can get heroin or other opiates. Here in America, you can get methadone or Suboxone, buprenorphine, which is another opiate. There are different policies in different places, but the idea of giving addicts whatever they think they need is actually pretty successful in a lot of places. In Portugal, they've been doing it for about 10 years in the sense that they have decriminalized all drugs, so people don't have a hard time getting the drugs that they want, and they don't commit crimes to do so. And guess what? Drug problems go down drastically, consistently, across countries and across programs.
Let's take another call. Troy from Hicksville, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi, thanks. I wanted to see what you thought about the advantages of using a drug such as Ibogaine over a 12-step program.
Yeah, it's hard to make that comparison. The success rate for 12-step programs for AA, for example, is estimated to be between 5 and 8 or 10%.
Really? I always thought it was much higher.
No, it's not. And
I guess we only meet the people who continue going.
Well, it's a really complicated story because the way they do – first of all, they don't do outcome stats directly, but there have been studies done. And the way they measure success is by zero relapses, and other – programs measure success in different ways. So they might measure success as a reduction in use rather than total abstinence. So anyway, problems with AA, but for some people it works, and for some people it's the end of the line. And the most serious people with the most serious problems end up there, and some of them do get better. So
they say when you hit rock bottom, that's when you go.
Yeah. I mean, when you hit rock bottom is when you go for treatment. I mean, you might try a lot of different things, and AA might be the 10th or 100th or 300th time you've hit rock bottom. In my book, I talk. I mean, most of the five addicts whose stories I tell these. There's a chapter on each of five people, a very intimate biography of each of five addicts, as well as some explanation of what's going on in their brains. I try to tell their stories quite intimately, and most of them have tried AA or other 12-step groups at some point, and then moved on and moved out and gotten some other form of treatment, which they ended up finding more effective.
Alex from Brooklyn, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
We're well.
So I'm listening to this, and I myself am in AA after many years of struggling with alcoholism, and started drinking when I was a teenager. I don't at all agree with the premise that it's not a disease. I firmly believe it is a disease, and your guest reference to in the early days calling it an allergy and those, well, the word allergy, that was just the beginning of identifying it as a disease. I believe very strongly that it runs in families. It runs throughout my family. And it's the group aspect of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the identification with other alcoholics. Mm-hmm. That is so key to recovery, and I understand, you know, I know that statistically, I guess it's AA does not have high success rates according to what people say, but if you go to an AA meeting and you see the people who go to the meetings and talk and identify with each other, everyone who is there understands that picking up a drink.
I agree with you. Can I answer? I really agree with you that the group process is really important, and the mutual support and care is tremendously valuable. That, I think, is the best thing about AA. The fact that it's free also is really important for a lot of people. I'm not an AA basher, not at all. Some people have made a kind of a career out of bashing AA. I don't do that. I think it is useful for some people. For others, it's not. Yes, you see addiction as a disease, and I wouldn't want to take that away from you if that's helpful to you, but in my scientific analysis, I don't think it meets the criteria at all. And in talking to a lot of addicts don't want to see it as a disease. It's helpful for some. For others, they say, no, I don't want to see people, especially who've recovered, work pretty hard at it and have been very successful at it, don't want to see themselves necessarily as still having a chronic disease which could relapse at any time. They'd rather see themselves as moving on. So the definition does not work for everybody.
My guest is Mark Lewis, whose latest book is The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. It's published by Public Affairs. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You refer to yourself as a former addict. Most people actually refer to themselves as recovering addicts. What's the difference?
So the cultural buzz phrase now is recovering addict, and that is supported by AA and other recovery movements. The premise being it kind of converges with the idea of a chronic disease. You're never free of it. You're always in a stage of recovering, ongoing recovery, which means
one drink can get you right back.
Exactly. So you have to be careful. You have to control yourself. You have to never forget that you have this great vulnerability. And that's okay. And I also feel that I have to be careful when I take pain medication because I, at one time, was addicted to opiates, and I have to be careful that when I need it, I need it, and when I don't need it anymore, I need to stop.
How did your addiction take hold in the first place, and what effect did it have on your life?
I was in my late teens when I started taking drugs. I had just come out of a repressive boarding school to Berkeley, California. It was 1968. It was the height of the drug culture. And to me, it was like I had gotten really depressed at boarding school. It did not suit me well. It was kind of militaristic and horrible. And then there I was in Berkeley, and it was sunny, and there were girls around, and there were drugs around, and I kind of dived into it. And then it took root. And then by my mid-20s, I was really into opiates more than anything else. And that's when it became quite a strong psychological addiction, and I had a hard time stopping.
And how did you overcome it?
It took me years and many attempts and getting in trouble and, serious trouble, getting convicted of crimes. And finally, it got so aversive to me that most addicts actually quit. People don't realize that, but most addicts quit. And many, sometimes the majority of addicts quit without treatment. I tried psychotherapy a couple of times. Didn't work for me. What did work was I started meditation, Tai Chi. I became so disgusted with the drugs itself. My whole perspective moved around. And instead of thinking of it as something I wanted but couldn't have, I started thinking of it as something I really didn't want. And that shift in perspective was really helpful for me.
How effective are drugs like methadone in treating narcotic addictions?
Methadone and the contemporary equivalent, which is Suboxone or buprenorphine, are very useful for people who just have a hard time stopping. Okay, get on a maintenance dose, control it through this. That way you don't have to go through withdrawal and you don't have to feel that emptiness that keeps coming back when you're off drugs. So I don't knock it. I think it's probably not the optimal solution, but it's very useful and very helpful for many people.
Some people have asked about hypnosis. Listeners have been calling in. Huh. What do you think?
I have no idea how effective that is.
Now, there are certain parts of the brain, obviously, that are most heavily affected by addiction. Does it matter whether we're talking about a mental or a physical dependency?
No, it doesn't. And that's one of the most interesting things. So in my book, I tell the stories of four substance addicts, one heroin, one methamphetamine, one pharmaceutical opiates, and one alcoholic, but also the story of an eating disordered person. And there's an addiction.
That was Alice.
That was Alice, right. And she had a really serious eating disorder. And the brain chemistry and the activity levels in particular areas of the brain are very much the same for people who have binge-type eating disorders and people who have drug addictions. Really similar, indistinguishable. So it doesn't matter whether it's a drug or a behavior. Addiction activates certain parts of the brain and activates them in such a way that neural pathways get reshaped and changed and the habit gets entrenched and dug in deep ruts.
The striatum.
The striatum is a big deal. That's the center. That's the part of the brain that's very old and that causes us to go after goals, focus on goals, and feel the urge to go after goals because we're attracted to them. The book is called The Biology of Desire because it's all about desire. And that's where the striatum comes into play. And that's where a lot of the circuitry gets reconfigured by whatever it is you're attracted to, whether it's drugs, booze, gambling, or the girl next door.
Let's take another call. Abel from Brooklyn. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, Leonard. And thank you for doing this segment. I have a question for your guest. If I understand that you're making the medical argument, the scientific argument, that addiction is not a disease because it just hijacks the brain's natural functioning, but why can't you make the analogy to something like an autoimmune disease where the body's natural resources and its natural functions are hijacked by another stimulus, external stimulus, and then it sort of turns in on itself, especially if you just said that any type of addiction, be it narcotics or an alcohol or gambling, can actually reshape the brain physically by rewiring the neurons.
Mm-hmm. You can make the analogy to an autoimmune disorder. I mean, it's an analogy. And calling it a disease is also an analogy. It's not a homology. It's not the same thing. The fact that people use cognitive and motivational tools to get out of addiction through effort, perspective change, thinking about their future in a different way, recognizing that they can control their behavior through cognitive tricks and through fastening their desire to different goals that are inconsistent or incompatible with their addiction. There's no disease that I know of that effort and cognitive control itself can get you absolutely past it.
Now, you are very open about the fact that you used to be an addict. Many people will not admit to it because there's a stigma attached.
Right.
How do you get past that? Should people openly acknowledge it, you probably can't get a job in some areas.
There are so many people who have gone through addiction of one sort or another. I think the public perception is changing. But you're right, there's still certainly a stigma attached, and it can be it can be unhelpful. It can even be destructive, as you say, getting certain kinds of jobs. And so, but you know, I hope that society continues to change to become more understanding. And I think an important, what I try to do is to fuse scientific insights with human insights in my book and in my work, because that's how we're going to understand it better and learn not to blame, but to help and forgive and support people who are getting out of their addictions.
I want to sneak Vic from the Upper West Side into this. Vic, we have very little time. Can you make your point quickly?
Sure. By the way, I'm a member of Agnostic AA, which is a very fast-growing movement within AA. But I take a question of success rates. There actually is no definition of success. What's success?
Right.
A year, a month, never drinking again or drugging again? I mean, AA doesn't give out any statistics, so all these claims of success are rather dubious. I just also want to say that is a program of abstinence. And so if you're going to do AA, you don't do anything. There are others which have harm reduction, moderation management. Fine. If that works for you, fine. But you can't knock AA because AA says they use abstinence.
So in the end, what Vic is saying is whatever works best for you is the best thing.
And I certainly agree with that. And by the way, I don't go around knocking AA. Like I said, it's not how I spend my time. It works for some.
Thank you so much for being on our show, Mark Lewis. His book, The Biology of Desire, Why Addiction is Not a Disease. He is a neuroscientist and professor of developmental psychology at Radboud University in the Netherlands. His book is published by Public Affairs, and I thank you so much for being on our show.
You're welcome. Thanks for inviting me.